Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to Long Distance from the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. And this is Long Distance, a podcast-only series of conversations with great contemporary writers about their new books. Here's your host for the podcast, Amanda Bullock, the Director of Public Programs for Literary Arts.
Hi, I'm Amanda Bullock. Welcome to the sixth and final episode of season one of Long Distance. This podcast, for me, has been a good thing to come out of the honestly terrible summer of 2020. We've definitely been learning as we go, and I think getting better and better. And I've been so grateful for the chance to talk to the writers we have featured and to share their work with you. Kristen Arnett, Megha Majumdar, Jean Kyung Fraser, Emma Straub, and Kelly Jo Ford, who are the authors of some of my favorite books of summer 2020. Today, I am thrilled to share my conversation with Raven Leilani, author of the widely and deservedly acclaimed debut novel, Luster. We talked about race and sex and art and work, the sweaty magic that is disco music, faith and its loss, and unsurprisingly, given how funny the novel is, we laughed a lot. If you've listened to this podcast, you most likely have caught on that as a reader, I really love dark humor. As Raven says herself about Luster, the book goes into the dark, but it also makes room for joy. I really loved it so much, not only for Raven's unforgettable characters, but for the honest portrayal of being young and hungry and hustling. And I have to say again, it is very, very funny. I spoke to Raven, who is in Brooklyn, New York, from my home in Portland, Oregon. Take a listen to our conversation. Thanks so much, Raven, for Zooming in today. It's good to see you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and are you in New York right now?
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn. I've been in Brooklyn, since the pandemic sort of kicked up here, we kind of just hold away in our apartment, and now we're like just starting to be able to kind of take walks and stuff. So, but I've been here for, I haven't left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same. I've been pretty much in this room for 4 months as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's great. I'm so excited to talk about Luster. Congratulations. The podcast will come out next week, but we're talking the day after it published. So huge congrats on that.
Thank you.
Happy book birthday. And before we talk, if you could just describe the book a little bit,
Sure.
What it's about to you in your own words, and if you could read a little bit, that'd be great.
Totally. So we'll start from the beginning when I read, but when you start the book, you meet Edie, who is the protagonist, and she is, an aspiring artist, but also a young woman who is looking for a connection. Looking to be witnessed and to be touched. This book is about desire. And so when you meet her on the page, she is meeting up for the first time with a man she's met online, a man who is in an open marriage. And so the first bit is about that. I'll read a little bit. The first time we have sex, we are both fully clothed at our desks doing working hours, bathed in blue computer light. He is uptown processing a new bundle of microfiche, and I'm downtown handling corrections for a new laboratory detective manuscript. He tells me what he ate for lunch and asks if I can manage to take off my underwear in my cubicle without anyone noticing. His messages come with impeccable punctuation. He is fond of words like taste and spread. The empty text field is full of possibilities. Of course, I worry about IT remoting into my computer, or my internet history warranting yet another disciplinary meeting with HR. But the risk, the thrill of a third pair of unseen eyes, the idea that someone in this office with that sweet post-lunch break optimism might come across the thread and seek tenderly how Eric and I have built this world. In his first message, he points out a few typos in my online profile and tells me he has an open marriage. His profile pictures are canned and loose, a grainy photo of him asleep in the sand, a photo of him shaving, taken from behind. It is this last photo that moves me, the dirty tile and soft recession of steam, his face in the mirror stern with quiet scrutiny. I save the photo to my phone so I can look at it on the train. Women look over my shoulder and smile, and I let them believe he is mine.
Thank you. It's so great to hear you read it. And I want to, actually, one of the things I really wanted to talk about, and you've talked about this a little bit, is the role of work in the novel, because it's like very much, and right away in the first sentence, they're at work.
Yes. I, you know, like that was, it was really important to me to have that be on the page. I think the fiction I'm drawn to, the TV I'm drawn to, has that component where you see characters at work, you know, where they're, you know, grappling with that fundamental question of how to, you know, how to survive, how to eat, how to pay rent. And that, because, you know, partly too, because I, you know, in making art, you know, writing, the question of what my 9-to-5 was and how I would, you know, how I would pay bills while also being able to make things, that was, those were really deeply intertwined. And so like, I wanted that to be on the page. And I also think that's character, you know, seeing how a character meets or doesn't meet those needs.
Yeah, I think like, because a lot of people are really defined by their work.
Yes.
In a lot of ways.
Right, it's most of your life, right? You know, like 8 hours a day.
Yeah, on a good day. Yeah. And then some people are working to live because, like Edie, who's just trying to pay her bills so that she has space to do this other thing. I remember I really appreciated that the jobs were really defined and you talked about work in the book. I remember the first time I read in high school, like Pride and Prejudice, because I was coming from this very like middle class perspective. I was like, what are their jobs? How do they have this makes no sense. Like, how can they be rich but they don't have jobs? I don't get it.
That's right. And you know, like the, you know, the first bits of the book, you see more of Edie at work, and you see her, you actually do see her trying to climb, but because she is, you know, she's a Black woman, there are different barriers to her you know, to her progress, you know, that she has to kind of perform depending on the room that she's in. And that in some ways that impedes her being a whole human, and it impedes her ability to, you know, to perform well at work. But I also just, you know, in writing about a story about an artist, I wanted to write about that balance, you know, how tricky that is, the balance to strike. Especially if most of your bandwidth, and later in the book, you know, I get to write a little more about even just like the gig economy, you know, the what it's like to want to make things, but spend most of your bandwidth of trying to survive.
Yeah, just being so, how do you have anything left when she's literally like running up and downtown all day?
That's right.
Spilling soup in her socks. And
yeah. That's right. Which I have done. I did work for Postmates for briefly, and those soup sections are, you know, drawn from life.
Mm-hmm. I hope that everyone who reads this book will never order delivery soup ever again. Yeah, the publishing sections were really great, just as I had, you know, a very different experience in publishing, but especially it being in the kids department, and
yes,
it was such an opportunity for humor. With just like those,
it was really fun to play around with that.
Because you also worked in publishing for a little bit, right?
I did. I was working in publishing while I was writing this book. And so I think because of that, a lot of that bled into the writing. And, you know, there are sections where I'm speaking quite directly to, you know, what I think is actually kind of a in the ether right now in terms of representation and diversity in publishing. In this book, you know, Edie, there's a section where she goes to a diversity giveaway they're having, and she goes to the table and she sees, you know, the offerings there, and the books are, you know, they're books written by people outside of the experience of the people they're writing about, or they're books that have sort of flattened the lived experiences of, you know, of marginalized people in a way that is maybe kind of geared to satisfying a market. And I think, you know, there was a part of me that wrote this with the anxiety of writing a story myself and wondering if there was room but I also wanted to, you know, I think diversity is necessary and urgent, and art is better for it. But I think in practice, in some, you know, in some spheres, it has an almost absurdity to it, you know? And so I wanted to speak to what that looks like, like almost the performance of satisfying that.
Yeah, she's like very aware of how clumsy the environment is and refers to herself as like the diversity hire and
right.
her tension with the other Black woman, or her
that's right
kind of self-created in some ways tension with that other
yes,
woman.
Yes. And like in those sections too, you know, you do see two professional Black women who have very different tactics of surviving. You know, it's just they're on the same spectrum, they just have very different. One has sort of deferred to a hyper-curation, and the other has just refuses to participate.
And then I wanted to talk to you about another through line in the book is music in a lot of ways. Like one of Edie's a time she has this deep connection with Eric is after they go to the disco club and like kind of realize they both like disco. And then with Eric's wife, Rebecca, also, they go to that insane field concert.
Yes. I mean, I just like, I love music so much. And I think, so that was part of it where I really just desperately wanted to write about music and about the music I love, which I, you know, it probably is no secret when you come to the page, but I love disco, you know, and you know, this book is a book that it goes into the dark, you know, and I wanted to have room to write bluntly about all of those dark parts, but I also wanted to make room for joy. And that disco is sort of like a central kind of part of that ethos, you know, what it looks like when Edie, who is, you know, very studied, who is distanced, you know, in her role as an observer, what it looks like when she articulates something she really loves earnestly. And even, you know, when she does that, she feels the pull of like, how can I make this a little cooler with, you know, irony. You know, it was important to me to have sections in the book where you see her enjoying herself, you see characters engaging earnestly with things they love. And with Rebecca, you know, that was really fun to write too. I don't mosh regularly, right? But like, I've been to a few, and there is, in general on the page, I'm drawn to environments that facilitate that kind of chaos, you know, on the page. Like I just love being able to write those scenes and being able to go, you know, have two characters go to a death metal concert and sort of lean into, well, the spirit of annihilation that is kind of throughout this book was really, really fun.
Yeah, I guess they're both very sweaty scenes. Like,
yes.
There's a lot of sweat in the book. It's a very wet book.
I wish that was a blurb, truly.
people talk about the sex a lot, and I guess this is disgusting to say, I guess, but it's like wet in that way, but it's also just bodily functions are just all over the place.
Very much. And that too was really important to me. Like, you're right. There's like a yuckiness about invoking wetness and juiciness, but like that was like really central in what moved me to write this book, which was to be candid about the parts that are ugly and strange and sweaty, you know, especially when it comes to sex.
Yeah. That's like a lot of the scenes where they're kind of Edie really seems to enjoy the distance of the online relationship and being able to construct Eric and construct these different things. And then when confronted with these actual bodies and like the actual secretions, the wetness of the bodies. Yeah.
But you know, like that also too is, you know, Edie is a character who is constantly calculating and curating, and that, you know, on the internet, you know, with a screen between you, you can more sort of nimbly do that. And like, I feel like I was almost writing from my own feelings about that, about the, like how awkward and how overwhelming it really is to be face to face, body to body with a person without the barrier that, you know, might allow you to kind of polish it up.
You said the word annihilation too, which was definitely thrums throughout the book, both in Edie constantly talking about dying and like being aware of death, And then also this climate anxiety that's throughout the book. There's a lot of talk about the burning to death and like the sun engulfing the earth and everything, which I really appreciated because I think about that a lot. So I just wanted to kind of just do this like fake question thing where I'm like, I just wanted to talk about climate anxiety.
No, but that is real. And that is an element of our time and in Edie's time that is, it's inescapable. It's inescapable and it's real and it's enormous. And so in a way it feels abstract, but I feel that dread creeping into all the conversations I have, you know, with people who are, you know, who are concerned about what's happening. But the idea of living now and being really being concerned about our future is just as a different kind of imperiled state that is sort of right alongside you know, her blackness, her womanhood, and I wanted to speak to that. You know, she is aware of those, you know, those death possibilities, you know, that danger around the corner in a way that is sharp and keen because, you know, she's a black woman and she's, you know, very, very aware and almost deteriorated by the, you know, the surveillance that she's constantly kind of managing. But she also, right, she lives in this kind of, you know, current moment. And she lives on Earth. And I think, you know, I think honestly that is the future of the book, if I can say, which is that it already is so. But I think, you know, as we move along, that will be really truly the central concern of fiction. And it crept into this book too, you know, just kind of as a matter of course.
I guess that makes sense. Like any book set on Earth now should be dealing with that or mentioning it, right, or at least acknowledging it in some way, in the same way you would be acknowledging things about the character's identity, like her blackness or like her work, yeah, or like her art or anything. And she is the Edie's role as an artist. One of the things that I really liked, and I know you're a painter too, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. One of the things that's great about the book is the colors. There's like colors are mentioned really often, like from the art department where she's like really fascinated. She talks literally about them, like changing the shades of blue in this, yeah, one spread. And then there's this like orange dawn right before the death metal concert. Or yeah, I was really struck by just like how colorful the book is in that way.
Thank you. I mean, color is deeply important to me. And I will say, one reason that is in terms of like my own painting is that, you know, early on when I thought painting was the thing that I was going to do, you know, before I kind of realized, no, I don't really truly have the kind of stuff or the will to really make a like go of it with my life. It allows for more room. It allows for room for like a more loose expression of the body, of the figure. Because for me, those sort of technical kind of fundamental building blocks, that the stuff that, about that part of art that's almost math, is really, really hard for me to grasp. And so I'm drawn to art that has strong color, like you know, you can feel the artist's fingerprints in it in terms of like I love impressionism, you know, which is you can feel the artist's mind in the sort of replication of the thing. I really love that, and I think that it just made its way onto the page. But also, you know, color has connotation, you know, and I think that's more, it's probably more true or more stark in a visual medium, probably, most definitely. But even on the page, you know, I really tried to engage with color in that way. You know, there's a moment where she is cleaning her palette, she's peeling the paint off of her palette, and she notices that it is dominated by blue, you know, and I wanted to speak to that, you know, because even when I paint, you know, it, depending on where I am and how I'm feeling, you know, the colors are different. So that's really cool that you noticed that. That's really important to me.
It really like enhances the book and just brings a new dimension to it in this way. It kind of like, I don't know, it just you're, like you said, you're able to kind of construct the scene in your head, but in this abstract way. It's not where you're like, oh, I know exactly what this person looks like because like their like ear was described. I don't know, but just gives you, it gives you this like other abstract dimension to everything. So it was really cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
And so we have talked about some of the biographical parallels you share with your main character.
Yes.
How is she the most different from you, would you say? Like, were there things that you liked? Just
yeah. I mean, I would say we are very different in disposition. You know, like it's interesting kind of publishing this book once it started to be a public thing. I almost felt that the people I met who'd read the book and not met me first had an expectation, right, that I would be Edie, not necessarily in my experiences, but in my like in my bearing. And I'm very much like I'm a quiet like house cat. Like, you know, I'm a really deeply introverted person, and I think there's an element of writing a character like Edie that is almost like wish fulfillment. You know, like a wish that I had and or could be as free as her. You know, and then there's also the part that is me as a 29-year-old person writing about a 23-year-old person who has the benefit of hindsight and is like almost writing like, you know, a love letter to a past self. Like, you will soon know, you know, you will still understand, you know, you don't have to do this. But I would say we're different in the way we go about life. I think I'm really kind of more subdued. I'm definitely more cautious. And I think I'd say Edie is, you know, she at that age, she is a little more dogged than I was in terms of, you know, trying to claim that art. There was really a moment in time in which I like felt, and she does too on the page, you know, but I really felt and surrendered to that defeat a little bit. And so again, like it's liberating to write a character who is like openly wanton and will just absolutely, you know, walk up to your house and open the door and go inside and drink your milk, you know, like that was, I think that's one way we're very different. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she is very wanton. She's very hungry. I mean, she's like literally hungry for a lot of the books. She
yes.
Yes, because of her bowels.
You know, but that too was really important to talk about, you know, like she cannot go to the bathroom, you know, like it is that the body, it is a place of such drama, especially for women. And it felt like an omission to like to not talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, because I read it a few months ago, and then I was reading it again to get ready for this and was newly struck. I'm like, she just never gets to eat. She's like existentially hungry and like literally hungry. I want to say too, the book is very funny. It's hilarious.
Thank you.
But it, in this very sharp way, where a lot of the humor is in these twists and this dissonance, which was really enjoyable. And I wanted to ask, like, what you find funny? What are some of your like what TV shows and what books that you really find humor in?
Oh gosh, I mean, I love Pete Holmes. Like he's a really great stand-up that because his comedy intersects with faith, which I really love. I love that sweet spot. So I also love Ronnie because he also does like his work is very much about like those God questions, but the way he looks at it is it has a real lightness and then heaviness and bluntness to it. I really love Jacqueline Novak. I think that she is. I saw Get on Your Knees last summer. It was the most brilliant thing I think I've ever seen, the way she unpacks the demands of femininity. Like, it blew my mind, you know, that real, I mean, honestly, observational comedy that it's just that feeling of yes, you know, yes, I recognize that. I would say, I mean, she's not a stand-up, but Zadie Smith is like hilarious, you know, like I would absolutely put her like up front as a person, a writer I look to, who is just, you know, her wit is like razor sharp.
Yeah, it's true. It's the observational humor. That's a good. And you mentioned faith and talking about that too. And I know you grew up, you just published a piece in Vogue about growing up in the Seventh-day Adventist church, which is something that Edie shares. And I don't know if I have this fully formed as a question, but a lot of my favorite writers and a lot of really funny writers have this deep, like, biblical scripture background. Like, I'm thinking of Patricia Lockwood and Mallory Ortberg.
And
I was just curious if you, again, I'm not good at asking questions, apparently. I'm just sharing observations and hoping that you have a response.
I mean, you know, I will say that is truly, truly so formative to my work. I think in this book, it actually is kind of more in the background, which sometimes I think about, and that's a little strange, because I think if I'm not writing about art, I'm writing about God. And there's an element of having really, really believed in God and sort of had a religion that meant so much, and it did. It meant so much to me, and I no longer practice. I'm an atheist now, but you know, I did really have a meaningful relationship with my religion. And once that kind of crumbles, once that's gone, once that's removed, you have to find new organizing principles. You know, you have to literally cobble together new gods, and that when you're doing that, it really forces you to look closely at everything, you know. And I think, I don't know, like, this is probably, I don't even know, this is probably not true, but like, the sort of close observation that you do when you are seeking is adjacent to humor, right? Because I think humor comes from seeking, from looking, you know, from cataloging. And in this book, I think the humor is more, you know, it's an understatement. Like, I think Britt Bennett, like, when she said that, I was like, yes, I couldn't find a way to articulate that. But, you know, the hyperbolic, you know, environments that Edie is often moving through, that up against the sort of understatement is really destabilizing and strange and funny, kind of incidentally, but also the friction between, you know, her private mind, you know, the kind of the candor that we see there, the rage we see there, and that friction up against the external performance that is demanded of her, there's an absurdity to that that I think lends itself to humor.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, we haven't talked about Akilah yet, but I like what you said there, because it reminds me of when she is in the kitchen with Akilah. And she's having hilarious thoughts about how she's like grateful for her abortion when she meets children. Yeah. And, and then she's so surprised when her voice comes out so small. And then she like kind of.
Yeah. Yes.
And that tension between what's going on in her head and then kind of how she's like expressing herself to Akilah. And speaking of Akilah too, the Comic-Con kind of climax.
Very fun to write.
Yeah, it's delightful. I really liked how you, when you were describing their cosplays, how you like described it first and then told us the character, so that if you knew, you could feel like you were like, you're like, oh no, I know that's Harley Quinn. Like, I'm cool.
I'm so glad it worked that way. That was 100% my intent. Like, that is like one of the most delicious things about fiction, or about bearing your kind of like own like little, you know, personal references, is like, you know, for the few who are as like obsessed as you, there's that real like beautiful inside baseball of like, I know that. Like, actually, I will say, last night someone messaged me on Instagram. They were reading the book, and there's a short passage about an anime that I really dig, and they messaged me, they're like, is this, you know, Attack on Titan? And I was like, it absolutely is. It is. And that, like, I live for that. I live for, you know, that, the recognition of that in there. And as far as like the Comic-Con scenes, like that too, much like the disco and like the death metal, that's an environment which I get to like absolutely slay and have fun and write around the chaos of that. But it also is one where I get to talk about something that's close to me, which is fandom and like an earnest engagement with fandom. And Akilah, who it was important to me have room on the page to feel joy, because in general, I think she is a kid who's caught a lot of hard breaks, and I wanted that for her.
Yeah, it's the Comic-Con is also very sweaty. is maybe a function of summer in New York, which is like living in an armpit.
Right.
Yeah, Akilah, man. It was really nice as a reader to be able to see her have that joy too. So that was really great. Is there anything, I know you're only day two of having the book in the world, but you have talked about it a bunch. And is there anything that you've wanted to talk about Luster that you haven't had a chance to talk about yet, or that no one has asked you about?
I mean, what's funny is you asked that question already, and that's the God component, because in Luster too is, you know, Edie is, and that's in the backstory, is, you know, a reformed Seventh-day Adventist. And I think that God hole that she has is also a formative part of this story, though it is very much in the background. But yeah, that's really, I guess, the only question I really haven't been asked as much. And you did ask it. Yeah.
God hole. It is a God hole. Yeah.
Fill it with something.
Yeah. Something. Just try a few things. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you're very busy, and I just want to say again, congratulations on the book. I love the shit out of it. It's so good.
Thank you so much.
I love a book that makes you laugh and then like punches you in the gut at the same time. And yeah, it's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. This is really a joy.
Well, I was so enthralled that I forgot to ask Raven for her reading recommendations during the interview, but she very kindly sent them after so that we can share them with you.
A few books that I really, really love are Want by Lynn Steger Strong. I also love The Lightness by Emily Temple, Days of Distraction by Alexandra Chang, also The Death of Vivek Oji by Akweke Emezi. I think those are really beautiful books, and I want to be able to support debuts.
I hope you'll pick up those books and a copy of Luster from your local independent bookstore. Since this is the end of season one of Long Distance, I want to say that it has been, unexpectedly for me, but honestly, really fun to share this podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed hearing from these authors. We're going to take a break from the podcast this fall while we focus on planning the virtual Portland Book Festival. In the meantime, I hope you get a chance to browse other episodes of the Archive Project and that you will join us for the Portland Book Festival in November. Keep an eye out for more Long Distance in 2021. Until then, thank you for listening and happy reading.
All right, that's it for this episode of Long Distance, a podcast series of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Long Distance is edited by Liz Olofsson, with production oversight from Crystal Liguori. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This podcast would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.